I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Michael Longley. Download the MP3 of our produced show with him at onbeing.org. Thank you. It's so amazing to be in Belfast. We're so delighted to be here with Corrymeela and Padraig, who's been a friend of the show, who's been actually on the show, and I will interview him again while I'm here, and a friend of the show in many ways. And to be at the MAC interviewing Michael Longley is a great honor, and I'm pretty daunted to interview you here in your city. I think I should say, just by way of introduction, that I am going to be introducing you to a largely American audience. And so I may go over some ground that will be very familiar to people here. And there may be some ground we don't tread on because we can't do it justice because of the complexity of it, the deep history of this place. One thing I was really aware of as we were preparing to come here, and I was preparing to speak with you, is that this is a place that in recent memory has moved away from sectarianism, however humanly and fitfully that happens. And we're at this moment where it feels like much of the rest of the world is drawing towards sectarianism. So I may be asking different kinds of questions than I would have asked even a few months ago, seeking a different kind of wisdom. I believe that some of what you know here, the rest of us need to know. And a piece of that is the importance of letting the voices of poets rise in the midst of tumult and be part of our way of finding our way back to the possibility of lived peace, finding out what that can mean. So thank you so much for being here, for accepting this invitation.
My wife used to say that she hoped Northern Ireland would become like the rest of the world, and she now points out that the rest of the world is becoming as Northern Ireland used to be.
Yes.
So this place has learned some very complicated lessons, and some of our politicians make me believe in the possibility of redemption. And compared with what Ulster was like or Belfast was like 10 years ago, the place is unrecognizable. And I'm rather proud. It's very incomplete and very imperfect, but we're getting there.
So I always begin my conversations, whoever I'm speaking with, whether they are a scientist or a theologian or a poet, by inquiring about the religious or spiritual background of someone's childhood. And that kind of takes us right into the dynamics here. And it's a question that I understand has a special intensity and layers of meaning for somebody who was born in a Protestant household of English parents in South Belfast. But how would you start to reflect on that, the religious or spiritual background of your childhood?
Well, my mother and father were English, which means that I'm an Anglophile, unavoidably British. But I was born on Ireland, on an island called Ireland, and I'm Irish, so I'm both those things. I'm both British and Irish, and that's what the Belfast Peace Agreement allowed me to be freely. My parents were lazy agnostics, and there was no religion was not part of my daily life as a child. When I was about 16, I had a rush of blood to the head, and I got confirmed in the Anglican Church by Bishop Elliot, I remember. And that was when I was about 16. But that kind of commitment has gradually faded. And I would call myself an agnostic.
Mm. But you also called yourself a sentimental disbeliever.
Yes. I envy people who have faith. Mm. When my wife had a fellowship in Cambridge, I used to visit her, and I went across the road every day of the week to St. John's for Evensong. Mm. And Anglican Evensong is a big part of my life culturally. Mm. But in a way, that's religion. I take the religion, I take the music and the words, the marvelous Anglican prayer book, mm. One of Cranmer's great gifts to the world. That's what I take out of it. When we turn east and say the creed, I'm afraid I don't believe a word of it.
Mm. Well, but when I think of the spiritual background of one's childhood, I think there's more to that than religion. I see how much you have thought about and written about your father's time as a, I think you say, a boy soldier in the trenches of the Great War. Mm. And you've written that when you were growing up, he would scream in his sleep. He was having traumatic memories. And to me, that also feels like part of what would have colored your sense of the world, its morality, its safety.
Well, the mystery of his survival. I mean, he joined up as a boy soldier in 1914, and he survived to the end of the war, where the survival rate was about 3 weeks at certain times. Mm. So that's a mystery to me, that he survived and that I'm here. I do believe in the transcendental, you know. I believe that poetry and art without a transcendental element doesn't really exist for me. But I'm completely outside any notion of organized mm-hmm. religion. And it is slightly sentimental, as you quote me saying. I mean, once every 4 or 5 years, I take communion. I'm in church, and I remember in a beautiful Swedish town, Lund, mm. We went to this Lutheran church, and it was a female pastor, and she was giving out communion. And I said to my wife, I said, I'm going up. And I went up and I took communion, and I looked deep into her eyes, and it was a deep experience. Mm. Whether it was religious or not, I don't know, and I don't really care. And then we had a New Zealand poet called Fleur Adcock staying with us, and she's a believer. She wanted to go to our local church where I was baptized and confirmed, St. John's Boulogne, on Ascension Day, and I took her there. And she went up to take communion, and I went with her. And I believe in the poetry of it, you know, and mm. the poetry of it. And I'm interested in Jesus as a revolutionary poet, mm. As a proto-socialist, although don't tell Donald Trump that.
I'm not sure Donald Trump is very interested in Jesus, come to think of it.
He hasn't run him down yet anyway, has he?
What?
He hasn't run him down yet.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't given him a name.
No.
But proto-socialist might
yes, well, I think the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, mm-hmm. are as good a system to live by as any mm. that I can think of, and mm. I love them. I love them.
Mm. I think this is something you've said, that poetry is about all of the things that happen to people. War is one of them. Did you say that? I always get nervous about quoting things people said to journalists. Does that sound like you?
I don't mind you quoting that. That okay. Really, I mean, you may quote some rubbish later on.
Okay. You call me out if I do.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me, you know, you became a sense one of the people who people would call one of the poets of the Troubles, and that was what was happening to people.
Yes. The poets of my generation, you know, Heaney and Mahon and Simmons, we were very cautious. There was kind of pressure. But during the Second World War, people said, where are the war poets?
Yeah.
And a cry similar to that went up here. But we were very cautious. And I believe that a bad poem's a big enough offence, but a bad poem that invades the lives of people who are in the community, who are suffering, who have been bereaved or whatever, is an impertinence. And we were anxious to avoid being impertinent. But and I've written somewhere that a poet is not like some super reporter.
Right.
That the raw material of experience has to settle to an imaginative depth, where it can then come out as true art. And there was an awful lot of what we call Troubles trash, dreadful novels, and execrable poems. And we avoided that. My friends and I like to think I avoided that. And the poems eventually came. There's a lovely poem by Mahon called Afterlives. There's a beautiful poem by Heaney called Casualty. Mm. And these are immortal poems that were born out of our conflict. And I remember in 1994, there were rumours that there was going to be an IRA ceasefire. And I was reading the Iliad, which is the greatest poem about war and death and suffering. And there's this wonderful passage in it where the old king of Troy, Priam, goes to the tent, plucks up courage, goes to the tent of Achilles to beg for the body of Hector, his son, whom Achilles has killed, and Achilles is mutilating the body, dragging him after his chariot. Priam visits Achilles and begs for the body of Hector. And it, for me, is the soul of this great work of art, the first great, and probably still the greatest poem in European literature. And I thought, wouldn't it be marvellous? This was August 94. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could compress this quite long episode into something like a sonnet and make my own contribution to the peace process, as we called it. And this poem emerged. It's probably my best-known poem.
The Ceasefire, right?
Should I read it?
Yes, please do. I meant to say, we will read some poetry. You will read some poetry. And I brought some, but I also asked Michael to bring some poetry, and we'll see how we'll do that as spontaneously as feels good.
Ceasefire. Put in mind of his own father and moved to tears, Achilles took him by the hand and pushed the old king gently away. But Priam curled up at his feet and wept with him until their sadness filled the building. Taking Hector's corpse into his own hands, Achilles made sure it was washed, and for the old king's sake, laid out in uniform, ready for Priam to carry, wrapped like a present, home to Troy at daybreak. When they had eaten together, it pleased them both to stare at each other's beauty as lovers might. Achilles built like a god, Priam good-looking still and full of conversation, who earlier had sighed, "I get down on my knees and do what must be done and kiss Achilles' hand, the killer of my son." Now, that appeared then in the Irish Times, the week of the ceasefire. And I was walking down the Lisburn Road, and a man came up to me and he said, "I really admired," he called it my Achilles poem. He said, "I really admired your Achilles poem, but I'm not ready for it." My son was the victim earlier this year of a punishment beating. I'm not ready to forgive. And I wondered to myself, was this poem of mine the premature? I mean,
Was it what?
Premature.
Uh-huh.
When I wrote it, there was a wonderful guy in Enniskillen called Gordon Wilson. He was a draper, and he was blown up beside his daughter at the Enniskillen atrocity on Remembrance Day. And a couple of days later, with his arm in a sling and plaster in his face, he said to the television cameras that he forgave the killers of his daughter. Didn't even call them murderers. And I had his face in my mind for Priam when I wrote that poem. But I thought, and there were people from Enniskillen who said they weren't ready either, that not everybody could behave with the extraordinary, almost superhuman magnanimity of Gordon Wilson. And I thought perhaps my poem might have been premature, that it might have been too symmetrical and neat and tidy. So I wrote a kind of awkward, gauche corollary to Ceasefire. And I'll read that one.
Is that
it's about the Lisburn Road.
Ice Cream Man?
No, that's another one.
That was another. So what's this one?
This is about the Lisburn Road, which, as you don't know, but I will insist, is the center of the universe.
Well, yeah. No, and I wonder, you've said it's a very particular exposed artery of Belfast.
Yes.
So just say a little bit of that about what, for you, Lisburn Road represents.
I do my shopping. And it used to, less so now, a lot of it has been gentrified. But in my boyhood, coming from the centre of Belfast up the Lisburn Road towards Lisburn, on the right-hand side was working class, two up and two down houses. And then on the left-hand side, much more prosperous, rhododendron gardens and dentists and solicitors and people like that. So in a way, the whole class mix or confusion was symbolised by the Lisburn.
And that juxtaposition is unusual.
That one?
That juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Belfast is full of these strange juxtapositions. In that case, class, but in other parts of Belfast, in what are called interface areas, we have Catholic zones and Protestant zones, ghettos almost. That's all part of the complication that you referred to earlier. But This is all of these people. And it's really my message to the world, you know, that it's in the first line, that in the first couple of lines, who was it who suggested that the opposite of war is not so much peace as civilization? He knew our assassinated Catholic greengrocer who died at Christmas in the arms of our Methodist minister, and our ice cream man whose continuing requiem is the 21 flavours children have by heart. Our cobbler mends shoes for everybody. Our butcher blends into his best sausages, leeks, garlic, honey. Our corner shops sells everything from bread to kindling. Who can bring peace to people who are not civilized? All of these people, alive or dead, are civilized.
It seems to me that that the distinctive place that you carved out for a poetic voice, an artistic voice, was this quiet, in the midst of this atrocity, was this quiet, insistence on celebrating normalcy and noting normalcy and the persistence of human activities in life in all its aspects, including the garlic,
yeah.
Right? The,
yeah.
The enlivening details that remained.
Well, have you read any concentration camp literature? No, the greatest book of the last century for me is Primo Levi, and in that kind of nightmare, what kept people sane was thinking of the ordinary things back home. What made things slightly less nightmarish would be securing a toothbrush, you know. Or women's things for sanitary purposes. And sanity itself depends on these banal, commonplace little things. There's no doubt about that.
I think The Ice Cream Man is another beloved poem of yours. And would you read that one?
Yes.
To that point that you just made, it also. Actually, I have it in here if you...
Do you?
Yeah.
I've got it here. It's okay. This was a man called Seymour, and he was murdered on the Lisburn Road, and I had been botanizing in a beautiful part of County Mayo, looking for wild orchids. And as a little exercise, I put in a little green notebook in my pocket all the flowers I'd seen in one day. And I came back, and this awful thing had happened, and my younger daughter, who was a regular customer and knew all the ice cream flavours by heart, she said, told me the news, and that she had used her pocket money to buy a bunch of carnations to lay on the pavement outside. And what I did, almost sleepwalked into this poem. I made a kind of pattern of the flower names in my book, and I made a kind of a metaphorical wreath of the flower names. And the poem's addressed to Sarah, my daughter. The Ice Cream Man. Rum and raisin, vanilla, butterscotch, walnut, peach. You would rhyme off the flavours. That was before they murdered the ice cream man on the Lisburn Road, and you bought carnations to lay outside his shop. I named for you all the wild flowers of the burren I had seen in one day. Thyme, valerian, Loose Drive, Meadowsweet, Twayblade, Crowford, Ling, Angelica, Herb Robert, Marjoram, Cow Parsley, Sundew, Vetch, Mountain Avens, Wood Sage, Ragged Robin, Stitchwort, Yarrow, Lady's Bedstraw, Bindweed, Bog, Pimpernel. And that list is supposed to go on forever, really, you know. If you like, that's a kind of a prayer.
Mm.
That's an agnostic's prayer. Now, if I can find it, I got this wonderful letter when this poem appeared.
Is that from the mother? From
yes,
yes. That
can
you,
I,
yes, please. That
I,
you, that you. I read that that you. She wrote to you, the mother of the ice cream man.
Yes. It says, "Dear Mr. Longley, my daughter bought your book, Course Fires, for me after hearing you on the radio. Your verse on the ice cream man was clear to us who you were writing about. But I do appreciate very much that someone outside our family circle remembered my son John. The fact that there were 21 flavours of ice cream in the shop and you wrote 21 flowers was coincidental. I do bless you for your kind thoughts, and may God bless you sincerely, the ice cream man's mother, Rosetta Larmer." Mm. Well, I'm very proud of that letter.
Yeah. What does that mean to you, that letter?
Everything, really. Mm. Means, like, all the good reviews I've ever had in my life rolled into one one letter. Mm. By a woman who probably wasn't a great poetry reader.
And there's something, I mean, you used the word transcendence a little while ago, and there's, I wonder if wonder, a sense of wonder, is connected to that. I mean, the flowers that grow so freely are so ordinary, but so beautiful, and so, and even the language, right? Then their names are so lyrical.
Yeah.
It's almost like each of their names is a poem.
Yeah. Well, that is all a transcendental experience. Mm. For me, my heart stops when I discover an orchid.
Mm.
I nearly crashed the car I was driving with my wife to Mayo a few weeks ago, and there was a huge orchid. I said, "Oh, look, you're supposed to keep your eye on the road." I'm in danger. I'm a danger as a motorized botanist. Then when I hear a bird sing, you know, it goes through me like an electric shock. And these are the things that matter to me. And I would call that transcendental.
Mm-hmm.
But on the troubles, I wrote a very angry little squib a couple of months ago, which is called The Troubles. It's only about five lines long.
I was hoping you would read that one.
Yeah. The Troubles. I hate the title. I hate the word Troubles. I didn't go to the Troubles exhibition at the Ulster Museum because I didn't think it was an exhibit, you know. I didn't think the Troubles were over while we have so many people who are sorrowing and are damaged physically. I thought it was a deeply presumptuous thing to have a kind of exhibition where we can all to attract visitors.
So was this poem a response to your reaction to the exhibit?
Partly a response to that. Yeah, it's very short.
Mm-hmm.
The Troubles. Think of the children behind the coffins. Look sorrow in the face. call those 30 years the years of disgrace. And I do finally think it was all pointless, I'm afraid. And Sinn Féin are doing what the IRA were asked to do 40 years ago, you know. And we have got our peace process. I think the unionists are too stupid to realise that they won, and Sinn Féin are too clever to admit that they lost.
Well, this is where you've lost all the Americans who might be listening.
Anyway.
I wonder if we could... I want to shift a little bit. I listened to something you did for Radio 3 a few years ago, where they asked poets to write their own version of Rilke's letter to a young poet.
Oh, yes.
You remember that?
I do, yes.
It was lovely. I think you addressed yours, I think it was Dear Alison.
Alison, yes. I wanted a nice middle-class Northern Irish
okay.
name.
See, I didn't get that nuance. So Rilke, in this line which you quoted to Alison, which I quote all the time, you know, Rilke wrote about love, that love is the utmost, the ultimate trial and test, the work for which all other work is just preparation. And you've said that love poetry is at the heart of the enterprise, but when you say that, you're taking love out of a little box of romance. I mean, that's in there, I think.
Yeah.
But you say you love poetry about all of the loves of our lives.
That's
love right.
Love
in all its forms.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe that if poetry was a wheel, the hub of the wheel is love poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But then branching out like spokes are the other affections and obligations and responsibilities and loves, like friendship and loving your country, loving nature, and so on. Yeah.
Right, I mean... I think even in a couple of the poems you've read, The Ice Cream Man or All Those People, there's a love of that particular humanity and of this ordinary beauty that's growing around us all the time.
Yes. There's a line by John Clare that I adore. I love John Clare. I revere him. Poets love nature and themselves are love.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that with all my heart, really.
Mm-hmm.
And part of writing is adoration. It's a kind for me celebrating the wildflowers or the birds is like a kind of worship. Yeah.
And I'm so intrigued to put that together with this kind of poetry speaking to the troubles, right? But that is also this gentle insistence in your work. I don't think it's an agenda, right?
No,
it's an effect.
Agenda. Right? I stagger around. I'm like a blue bottle bumping into walls. And I had a decade when I wrote hardly anything in my 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was finished. And lo and behold, I started to write again. I have said that where poems come from, I have no idea. And if I have a plan, if I think... I'd love to write a poem about that, and I do a bit of homework on the subject. It doesn't work at all. I've got to be taken by surprise. And if I'm not surprised, nobody else is going to be surprised. And I had a this professorship. I was the Ireland professor of poetry, which sounds wonderful, doesn't it?
I think it's the equivalent of the poet laureate. Is that right, Padraig?
It's a bit like that, yes.
Yes.
I wanted to be promoted to the world. the world poet. The thing about it was, meeting the young people. I really loved that, and having students. And they used to ask me about my schedule. Do you want to call it schedule or schedule?
Schedule. Schedule, yes.
Yeah, and I used to say, well, I don't write anything for 10 years. True. And then all of a sudden I write 3 poems in a day. Also true. So that's it, you see. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't... I don't really know where it comes from. And wasn't it Jesus who said, if your left hand knows what your right hand does?
I think something like that.
It might be the other way around, right and left. sorry, Jesus. they cut it off. And I think that's very good. And I think one can be too self-conscious. Mm-hmm. I think art and poetry require a certain insouciance. Mm. Otherwise you'd get knotted. And I think it's very important. You can take your poems seriously, but you mustn't take yourself seriously. I'm certain of that. And that self-importance engraves its own headstone.
Right.
And no names, no pactro. I never can think of
it. I think you had that in your letter to a young poet as well.
Yeah.
That advice.
I also did I quote my dear friend, old friend, was a wonderful, grumpy man, John Hewitt. I loved him dearly, but he said this wonderful thing to me once. Somebody was complaining within earshot of being under-recognised, and John turned to me and he says, if you write poetry, it's your own fault. Isn't that great? And I believe that too.
Well, I know what you did. You said, Rilke said, only write poetry if you must, right?
Yes.
If you can't not, if you only write if you can't not write poetry. And you said that that is a more winsome and practical.
Sorry?
You said that line, that if you write poetry, it's your own fault.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
I know nothing more exciting than writing a poem. Mm. And all of that 10 years, I half hoped that I would write another poem. And I did try, but they were all fakes, you know. If you have quite a lot of technique, which now, after 60 years of scribbling, I have, it's too easy to produce forgeries. And there are books upon books full of forgeries. So it's I do believe that, you know, if you don't have anything to say, say nothing. And that silence is part of the enterprise. Mm. And silence is sacred too.
Right.
You know, not to. I've been writing, scribbling away. I wrote a poem today.
Did you?
Yeah. I was going to sit down and think about myself for you. I said, you know, I was going to try and, put on a good show for Krista. but instead of that, you'd be glad to hear I wrote a poem.
Did you bring it with you?
Yes.
Would you read it to us?
Yes, if I can find it in this. I may not be able to find it. I probably can't find it, okay. Imagine what a build-up that was, and I can't find the bloody poem. Yeah, it was from Homer. It was from the Odyssey, but we can put it on hold, can't we?
All right, yes, we can. So, I mean, so I'll refer to this one more time. Like your letter to a young poet. You said your two favorite definitions of poet are the Scots word "macher" or "maker," And Horace's phrase, priest of the muses. And you've been getting into that. And you, I mean, you said that you're talking about this magic, this mystery that made poets shamans in other cultures.
Yes,
that
that's right.
You're aware of that.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you've also spoken of the mystery of form. You prefer the word shape.
Yeah.
Just talk a little bit about that. Oh, that's so interesting.
Oh, yeah. I remember our great, we had a great professor of Greek at Trinity, where I read classics, Stanford, W.B. Stanford, very formidable man. And we were doing Aristotle's Poetics. And he said, next week I want to, he called us ladies and gentlemen, the first and last time I were ever called that, you know, ladies and gentlemen. He said, ladies and gentlemen, I want you next week to bring your own definition of poetry. And mine was, if prose is a river, poetry is a fountain. In other words, poetry uses language in a way that's free-flowing and at the same time shapely. And I do like the word shape. Mm. And I mean, there are much looser utterances, say, that I admire, you know, like Walt Whitman, who seems to be a truly great poet. But I would love to be able to write like that, but I can't. I'm a sucker for this. It's extraordinary. You start to write, and the first group of lines is a quatrain. And you haven't planned that. And then the next group of lines is a quatrain. And say, ceasefire.
Hmm.
That began because the episode begins with Priam hugging the knees in supplication of Achilles. I put that at the end, which was a rhyming couplet. I get down on my knees and do what must be done and kiss Achilles' hand, the killer of my son. And I remember thinking, if I can extract from this episode four quatrains, I have a sonnet. And that's, I solved the whole problem by thinking in terms, I worked out what I needed to say. I worked out what I felt by trying to write a sonnet.
Right, so the shape even formed the substance.
Yes, in poetry, the music and the meaning are inseparable. That's the mysterious thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful thing. There's a poet I loved meeting in New York called Stanley Kunitz. And he was 100 when I went to see him. Beautiful old man. And he wrote in the preface to his collected poems, which I'd recommend to anyone, that form was a way of conserving energy.
Mm.
Isn't that wonderful? Mm. He said, the energy soon leaks out of an ill-made work of art. He's absolutely right. So that's what form does. I mean, it's you can't have an immortal poem without formal precision and kind of happiness of form. I don't know. I can't quite, but it's a way of conserving form. And I remember talking to Heaney about this, and I said, you know, when you've quatrains have declared themselves. The poem has said, I'm going to be in quatrains. So you obey that. And I said, and when you have six, it's magic, isn't it? 6 4s 24. Isn't that magic? And he said, yes, yeah, sure is. Sure is. Yeah. So, I would love to write, among the great poems for me are D.H. Lawrence's Free Verse. I would love to write Free Verse. Do you know an American poet, Theodore Retke.
I know the name. I don't know his poetry.
Oh, what I envy you discovering Theodore Retke for the first time. And he wrote these, towards the end of his life, these great paragraph, psalm-like poems. And I would quite like to write like that. But I have joked, you know, when the buzz comes, you get a kind of a buzz round about that bold bit there. And he goes, you know, no poems on it, bzzz, and, bzzz, and a poem's on its way. And you... So what was I talking about?
You're talking about the mystical act of writing poetry.
Yes. Anyway, it's extraordinary.
Mm.
Yeah. Sorry, I've just lost complete. This is what's known you call in America, senior moment.
I want to ask you also about the mystery of place. And so Carrickskeewaun is a cottage in County Mayo that you and your wife and family have gone back to, it, I believe, for over many years. And you said something wonderful about, which is also kind of countercultural, at least in America, the beauty of going back to the same place over and over again.
Yes.
That you don't stop, that you notice more and more. It's not that you exhaust a place, that you go more deeply into it.
Yes, it's inexhaustible. Mind you, it is very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very remote. And we've been going there since 1970. And we carried our children through the river and through the channel. And now they come back. It was such a compliment to my wife and me that the children want to spend time with us. And they come back and they now bring their children, our grandchildren, on their shoulders through this really quite tough terrain. And every time I leave, I think, well, there can be no more Carrickskeewaun poems. I've exhausted it. But there always are poems. Mm-hmm. And the place is inexhaustible. And we discovered eight cygnets on the lake. I saw a kestrel. I haven't seen an otter for about 4 or 5 years, but my son-in-law and daughter, they saw an otter. And I mean, these are things that bring out a devout side of me. And the place, I mean, you know this, the phrase, travel broadens the mind.
Mm.
We do quite a bit of traveling, but I think it also shallows the line, the mind, that going back to the same place in a devoted way and in a curious way is a huge part of my life. And I'll be going there even when they have to push me in a wheelchair
through that rough terrain.
Yeah, and I'll be like Stanley Kunitz, who celebrated his 100th birthday by publishing a book. Yeah.
You wrote one poem that I pulled out was Remembering Carrickskeewaun. Do you have that one? Or I can, it's,
yeah.
I think it's in here.
That's about it.
Okay, we'll see who gets to it first.
Yes. I say I don't know my way around this book. He said, that's not true at all, by the way.
Here it is. Here it is.
this was a very special day when the children were young. And I'm remembering that day in Belfast, thinking of the details. And this is a hymn, if you like. Remembering Carrickskeewaun. A wintry night, the hearth inhales, and the chimney becomes a windpipe, fluffy with soot and thistledown. A voice box recalling animals. The leveret come of age, snipe at an angle, then the porpoises demonstration of meaningless smiles. Home is a hollow between the waves, a clump of nettles, feathery winds, and memory no longer than a day when the animals come back to me from the townland of Carrigskeewaun, from a page lit by the Milky Way. You like that one?
I do.
Yeah.
You said once to in another interview, you said it. I don't go to Carrigskeewaun for escapist reasons. I want the beauty, the psychedelic wildflowers, the call of the wild birds. I want all of that shimmering beauty to illuminate the northern darkness. We have peace of a kind, but no cultural resolution. The tensions which produce the troubles are still there. It is important for me to see beautiful Carrigskeewaun as part of the same island as Belfast.
Yeah. Well, I can't improve on that, Chris.
I want to keep shining a light on this gentle way that your poetry speaks indirectly but very directly to some, which it speaks with beauty and with normalcy, with ordinary things, with the liveliness of ordinary things, to also what is hardest and most broken.
Yes. I have very complicated feelings about this. I don't altogether like the idea that art can be a solace.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I heartily dislike the idea that the civic commotion here might be good for art. I think that's right. You know,
mm-hmm.
I really dislike that. That's mm-hmm. on the same level as having a big room in the art gallery devoted to the museum devoted to the troubles. I don't like that.
Right. So what is it? So what is that? What does poetry do? What does it work? If it's not solace.
Well, it's much more complicated than solace.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Aristotelian notion of catharsis.
Mm.
And I think what art can do is to tune you up. I mean, if you think of an out-of-tune violin
mm-hmm.
and tuning it up so that it's in tune, I think that's what art is and that's what art does.
Mm-hmm.
And good art, good poems, is making people more human, making them more intelligent, making them more sensitive and emotionally pure than they might otherwise be. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And one of the marvelous things about poetry is that it's useless. It is useless. What use is poetry? People occasionally ask in the butcher shop, say. They come up to me and they say, what use is poetry?
Right.
The answer is, no use. But it doesn't mean to say that it's without value. It's without use, but it is value. Mm-hmm. It is valuable. And it's the first thing, the first people that dictators try to get rid of
mm-hmm.
are the poets and the artists and the novelists and the playwrights. I mean, look at, they burn their books.
Mm-hmm.
They're terrified of what poetry can do.
It keeps imagination alive.
It means that poetry encourages you to think for yourself and to disregard church and stayed dot. And but that's not exactly used. That just means it's got value. And the image that I love the most, I've loved it for years and years, is the English critic Cyril Connolly. Mm-hmm. And he compared art, the arts, to a little gland in the body, like the pituitary gland, which is at the base of the spine. And it seems very small and unimportant, but when it's removed, the body dies.
Hmm.
Hitler thought he could remove the gland, burn the books, and then burn the people, and the Third Reich didn't last very long,
mm-hmm.
mercifully.
I agree with you that there's something wrong about the idea that human catastrophe is good for art.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it is true that in the midst of human catastrophe, often, if not always, the poetic voice becomes more valued, more important.
Yes, I think that's right.
You know, I mean, I think it's not, it doesn't surprise me that, well, of course, this is a land that values poetry like no other. So it doesn't surprise me that poets were such important voices during the Troubles. But, you know, I lived in East Germany in the time of the Berlin Wall.
Yes.
And poets were heroes, right?
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get their work published, but you would sit around in these illegal rooms.
Yes, that's right.
And
it's
they were
fruit.
Keeping people alive.
Yeah, yes. That's a slightly more complicated thing, I think.
Mm.
We all know about falling in love or being bereaved and how we turn to poetry to write it ourselves, you know,
mm-hmm.
and at times of crisis. But that's not the same thing as going to it for solace, you know, the same way as one might go to Christmas cards or birthday cards or, you know, the dreadful verses which...
Right. No, this is much deeper.
No,
this
is much... It is a much deeper thing.
Yes, it is. It is.
And I really... In the ashes outside the crematoria in Auschwitz, they discovered scraps of poems.
Mm.
And these are people who were going to their deaths, and they found time to write a poem. Well, I mean, that says it all, doesn't
yeah.
it? It's a human active, normal human activity. I like that idea. It's a normal human activity. And even in extremis, we'll turn to it. And even if we're not writing poems ourselves, we will say poems to ourselves.
Sometimes not realizing they're poems.
Yes, perhaps. Perhaps. Yes.
When you were speaking a minute ago about form, the shape that words take, and how important that is, and how it also shapes what is said, the effect of what is said, it also strikes me that that's... and again, I don't want to be too linear, but it's modeling something like a care with words as a core value, as something at the essence of poetry. I mean, poetry would not exist without that. Care with words. That becomes such a critical
I think that's one of the
work for our society, right? Civic
one
work.
Of the duties of the art of the writer, the poet, is... to use words with precision. I think what poetry does is it uses words at their most precise and their most suggestive.
Mm.
And one word out of place and the poem's dead. It's shocking, but that's true. And our poets are custodians of the language.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sounds very grandiose, but I do believe it, you know. It's time to quote somebody else. You know, let me quote, you know, the end of Mossbawn Sunlight by Heaney. And here is love, like a tinsmith's scoop, sunk past its gleam in the meal bin. How simple and pure, you know. I love that. And I'll give you some American poetry. Wallace Stevens. Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon. The maker's rage to order words of the sea, words of the fragrant portals dimly starred, and of ourselves and of our origins in ghostlier demarcations, keener sounds. Now, I haven't a clue what that's about.
I'm so glad.
But it's about everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just, and I've had those lines by heart since I was about 20. And when you hear him read them, you know, he's a great reader. And he's the only poet I know of who was the vice president of a major insurance company. Not many of them around.
There's something in me that aches as we're having this conversation, because one of the things that has happened that is so corrosive right now in American life is a crass, careless use of words.
Yes.
And we have poets. We have amazing poets. They don't quite have the place in culture that they do in Ireland. And I think that the civic space gets handed over completely to reporters, pundits, analysts.
Yes, I know. But I was filled with joy when I listened to Michelle Obama.
Yes.
I thought that was poetry for me. Yeah. The alarming thing that happened in the Brexit referendum, and with Trump, Donald Trump, was you can tell a lie now, and it's pointed out that it's a lie. You don't apologize. You just repeat it. Then you go on repeating it. It's very worrying, I quite agree. So perhaps the poet should be more accurate, but you can't... all a poet can do is write good poems, and they may not be current for a long time. My wife has devoted a lot of her time to a wonderful Anglo-Welsh poet called Edward Thomas, who was killed at the Battle of Arras in 1917. And he said this wonderful thing, which I live by. He said, anything, however small, may make a poem. Nothing, however great, is certain to. So a good poem about, say, a daisy. Think of Robert Burns, a daisy or a little field mouse. Theodore Retke has written a beautiful poem about a mouse.
Okay.
And these poems may seem about little things, but they're so good in their expression that they civilize us. Yeah, it's programs like what your programs will, I'm sure, please people and get them to listen to not this awful garbage, you know. I listen to my children listen to stuff on the radio, you know, and I think, you know, my God, is this miracle, which is radio.
Yes.
It is a miracle, and it's been turned into a sewer. Anyway.
I'm going to I'm going to do my radio thing. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, in a special public conversation at the Mac Theater in Belfast with the poet Michael Longley. In 1999, and I think this may have been in The Guardian, you said, "I'm anti-clerical, full stop. I'm also an atheist or certainly an agnostic. However, I am interested in what it would mean to write religious poetry, particularly at the end of this god-awful century." And I wonder what you meant by that, and I wonder what you think it would mean to write religious poetry at the beginning of this god-awful century.
Well, by religious poetry, I really meant good poetry. That's it. I think a good poem is, in a mysterious, unmeasurable way, religious. But I was also thinking in a slightly more specialised way. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful Welsh poet called R.S. Thomas, and he was a vicar, he was a clergyman, and he wrote poems addressed to God, you know. I've met him a few times. I got on awfully well with him. Everyone was scared stiff of R.S. Thomas. I could make him laugh, and he could make me laugh. We joked away. I said, it would appear that you've been having an argument with God, Ronald. That's why he was called Ronald. You can see why he called himself R.S. Thomas, can't you? Been having an argument with God, and it would appear that God had lost. he thought that was tremendously funny. Yeah. But, I mean, there are great religious poems, you know, like Gerard Manley Hopkins, R.S. Thomas, and so forth. But for me, say the lines by Wallace Stevens that I quoted, the lines by Seamus that I quoted, mm-hmm. They're religious for me. They're religious poems. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You say that, I would say never trust anyone who calls themselves a saint or a mystic. And you also say one does not call oneself a poet.
Oh, God, I hate it when people say that. You know, you see people begin a sentence, "As a poet, I..." It just isn't on, you know? That's like saying, "As a saint, I..." It's
right.
Like calling
right.
yourself a saint.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if anyone called themselves a saint, you'd think they were loopy, you know? And I think anyone who calls themselves a poet or lays claim to that title at the very least, isn't a poet, because it's what you most want to be. And it's marvellous if other people call yourself a poet. Mm-hmm. But you can't say, "As a poet, I..." Mm-hmm. You're doomed.
This is something... Someone wrote this about you, and I believe you met him at Corrymeela, Richard Rankin Russell.
Oh, yes.
I believe you were at a gathering at Corrymeela quite a while ago. I just want to read you what he wrote about you. Longley's poetry, like Auden's before him, is religious in the best sense of the word, deriving from its Latin root, religare, meaning to bind fast or connect.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Will you take that?
I'll accept that as a compliment, yes. Yeah. I wouldn't dwell on it. That's the thing. My wife always says, you know, about compliments, she says, "Yeah, you accept them, but you don't inhale."
Well, I'd like to maybe I'd love for you to read a little bit more poetry before we end, but I would ask you one question, which is a vast question. So just how would you start to reflect on this through this life you've lived and the poetry that has been this magical part of what you've brought into the world? How do you think about what it means to be human? What have you learned about that?
Well, poets are no less or no more human than anyone else, you know. For me, it's quite an extraordinary gift to see something beautiful, say, like a lark or a flower, and to write about it. For me, no experience is complete, really, until I've written about it. And that's extraordinary. And it's a way of having more than one life. And I've actually been in quite intelligent conversation with people, and they don't realize that at the back of my head I'm finishing a poem. So I have this secret life that nobody knows about, except my wife, mm-hmm. who's the closest witness to what it's all about, and the best judge I know.
Would you read a few more poems?
Yes, if you want me to.
I brought...
I hope they're good.
I just love this. This is from your new... I think their newest collection, Angel Hill.
Yes.
Which maybe hasn't even been published yet.
No, this is it here.
Oh, that's it. Sea Asters.
Oh, yeah, I like
and,
that one.
This, oh, I hear it. I printed it out, or if you already have it.
No.
Good. Well, tell me why you like it. I loved it, too.
Well, to begin with, it's short and compressed.
Yes.
And the... Sea Asters, this beautiful purple, really humble flower. And this grows where my daughter lives, on a salt marsh. And this is just saying how magically wonderful it was to discover sea asters in this unlikely place, beside a fawn's skeleton. Sea asters. I have got to know the fawn's salt marsh skeleton, abstract vertebrae and white ribs in a puddle jellyfish fill at spring tide, ghost circles close to the sea asters' purple, golden-hearted, scruffy loveliness. Yeah. Have you another one there for me to read?
I have. I want to ask you, we talked about love poetry as something that is expansive, about many kinds of love. Do you have a love poem that you... It's one of your poems that you think of as a love poem in that tradition.
Can I read an earlier one?
Yes, yes.
It's
you can
six,
read anything you want.
No, it's six quatrains.
Okay. We can handle it.
The magic's 24. and it's also a kind of a love poem to this province. It's called The Linen Industry. And it's a poem I'm proud of. And it's six quatrains. And its resolving image is the bleach green. Now, when the linen was woven in the olden days, it was put out to bleach in the sun on a bleach green, so that at the height of summer.
Mm-hmm. And that was a huge industry here in Belfast.
Yes. Perhaps it'll come back, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it would appear that at the height of summer there'd been a fall of snow. That's really this. The linen industry. pulling up flax after the blue flowers have fallen and laying our handfuls in the peaty water to rot those grasses to the bone, or building stooks that recall the skirts of an invisible dancer. We become a part of the linen industry and follow its processes to the grubby town, where fields are compacted into window boxes and there is little room among the big machines. But even in our attic under the skylight, we make love on a bleach green, the whole meadow draped with material turning white in the sun, as though snow reluctant to melt were our attire. What's passion but a battering of stubborn stalks, then a gentle combing out of fibres like hair, and a weaving of these into christening robes, into garments for a marriage or funeral. Since it's like a bereavement, once the labour's done, to find ourselves last workers in a dying trade, let flax be our matchmaker, our undertaker, the provider of sheets for whatever the bed. And be shy of your breasts in the presence of death. Say that you look more beautiful in linen, wearing white petticoats, the bow on your bodice, a butterfly attending the embroidered flowers.
Do you have a poem that you would call a religious poem for the beginning of this century? Which I will take your translation as a good poem for this century.
Can I read a poem that I wrote just about a week ago? It's about growing old. And it's about Corrigskeewaun. And I think growing old is important. You know, my favourite quote on growing old is Ubi Blake. He was a jazz pianist, and he was still playing away when he was 100. And he said, if I knew I was going to live so long, I'd have taken better care of myself. So, this is about finding it harder to walk around this rough terrain, okay? And I'll read it. But it's not, nothing I write is aimed as high as you would suggest.
Yes.
Remember, anything however small may make a poem. Nothing, however great, is certain to. This is called Age. I've been writing about this townland for 50 years, watching on their hummock autumn ladies' dresses come and go, and after a decade underground, return in hundreds. I have counted the hoopers and the jackdaws over Morrison's barn. Too close on the dirk to tractor tracks, the ringed plover's nest has kept me awake, and the otter that drowned in an eel trap. Salvaging snail shells and magpie feathers for fear of leaving particulars out, I make little space for philosophizing. I walk ever more slowly to gait and style. Poetry is shrinking almost to its own bones. I got the last line wrong. Can I go over it again? I walk ever more slowly to gait and style. Poetry is shrinking almost to its bones.
I want to ask you to do one more. It's tiny. And to me, it's a wonderful example of, well, just what you just did, that juxtaposition of what is hard and extraordinary and beautiful and ordinary. And it's, I think this was about your father. You've written a lot about your father and
yes,
the war.
Yes, indeed.
And in, oh, where is it?
He died when I was only 20. And the poems I've written are really a kind of a conversation with his ghost, you know.
Was this about the Great War?
Which one?
Vimy Ridge.
Yes.
Yes.
Vimy Ridge, that's where
Vimy
the Canadians...
Ridge. Okay.
The Canadians suffered terribly. And it's not about him, but it's about some imagined
soldier.
Someone
there, yes.
Vimy Ridge. From a forward observation post the day before he is killed, he writes to his wife, "Between the terrific noise of the guns, I can hear two hedge sparrows making love."
Michael Longley, thank you so much.
Thank you.